Welcome back to This Week on Channel 9. I'm Brian Keller.
I'm Dan Fernandez.
Even more Windows Phone 7 goodness showing up here.
Yeah, we got some MVC HTML5 helpers.
You know I've been waiting for that.
Yeah.
And maybe a little bit of lab management.
All right, so let's get into this. So
a few weeks ago, we talked about the design guidelines for Windows 7. So this is printed documentation talking about things that you should think about as you go about designing
design
the UI and
sure.
the interaction and blah, blah, blah. And now we've got actual videos that you can sit down and get guidance on how to go about, as a designer, how to go about designing the UI and the way your users should interact with your Windows Phone 7 application.
Yeah, and you know, one of the cool things is the people that are doing these videos are the people that are building things like the Expression Blend designer support for the Windows Phone projects, or they're building the pivot and panorama controls. They can give you some of the idea on the Metro guidelines and how to build applications. So lots of value both for developers and especially for people that are looking to build a UX for Windows Phone.
Got it. Cool.
And for developers, something that just recently launched was a 12-part video series on how to get started on Windows Phone 7. So Rob Miles, who maybe you know,
yeah, from the UK,
he did
the Silverlight implementation of some game, right? Or
I think you're thinking of somebody else,
but he is
from the UK.
Yeah,
he was Andy Sterling's teacher.
Oh.
Actually.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Okay, I got
and
it
And James Lisiak as well.
I got it.
Okay, so this goes through a 12-part series.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the videos actually correspond to some of the content on Channel 9 for to go through hands-on labs as well. So definitely check this out. It's a great way to start Windows Phone 7 programming.
Awesome. I love it.
Love it, too.
So if you're writing your Windows Phone 7 app and you want to, say, have an event trigger that fires off a sound, here's a way to do that declaratively using XAML.
Yeah, so I personally have never built my own event or trigger, but what this allows you to do is have a triggered event action, like, you know, a button click or whatever. It signs up to a framework element, so it can basically use almost anything in XAML. And the nice thing is I can call into, within that code, it's building a dependency property, but I'm calling into the XNA framework, which is one of the nice things in Silverlight, and, you know, I can easily do sound effects. So it's kind of a nice way to declaratively call XNA libraries for sound.
So if I'm writing my first fart application for Windows Phone?
That's exactly a good scenario, because there may be times where you want to press it a lot, and
yeah.
you need a framework that isn't just, say, serial or
right.
like media element, or you want to press multiple ones, right? Because... there you go.
Awesome. All right, I'm going to go work on that.
Yes. Somebody has actually already built that.
I know. I saw Shia in Israel.
Yeah.
So this is the virtualized data in Windows Phone 7. So you say virtualized data. We had this discussion. I think of this as paging. I'm not sure that there's any difference there. But
yeah, so Peter Tor goes through what this is, and the idea being is the list box accepts a type of iList. And what that allows us to do is, instead of, say, IEnumerable, where you just kind of have a move next, iList has things like count, index of, etc. So basically, I can, within a list, rather than I have a million rows, and this is the example that he actually has, a million rows in data, I can virtualize the call to that, so I'm not actually loading in memory a million things, which would be some massive memory hog of a large object. I can just load what's needed for my list box. So say I have, you know, a list box that displays three things, it's only loading three things.
Got it. And then as you scroll through it,
it does the automatic. So it's a great, beautiful experience. Yeah. You're scrolling through a million items, no problem.
Got it.
So love it. And he has a code sample.
Okay.
That shows you how that works.
Nice. So, you know, we've talked about ASP.NET MVC. What do we have? Version 3 is in preview mode right
correct,
now.
Correct, correct.
Yep, and so so that converging with HTML5 opens up the question of what if I want to build an ASP.NET MVC application but render HTML5? And so now you can. You can use the ASP.NET MVC HTML5 toolkit.
Yes.
And then that will cause all the controls to render an HTML5 compliant code.
Yeah, so it's, you know, the input control. It's the HTML5 version of the input control and all those different controls. So you can go through there. It's pretty sweet, and they have kind of a walkthrough as well. So
nice.
Good stuff.
Definitely. So this is kind of funny. So our good friend, Wes Hutchins, friend of the show,
yes.
He works on the Visual Studio Core. And so one of the top bugs that they've had feedback from is apparently, I haven't noticed this enough, but If you do Control F for like find and replace, every time you launch that dialog, it grows by an additional 16 pixels. And so eventually, like it's kind of ironic that you can no longer find your editor because the find and replace is getting in the way.
Yeah, I love the way Wes put it here. On repeated use, this can quickly take up your entire screen real estate.
Written like a true tester. I love that.
Awkward.
So yeah, this is a patch that fixes that and gives you your screen real estate back, unless you, of course, can no longer find your browser because it's hidden behind the find and replace dialog, in which case you probably just have to format your machine.
No, actually, you can do the reset settings from the command line, and it would reset your profile settings. So.
But would it reset the size of those of that window as well?
I would believe so, because it may not even be docked or undocked. But we'll have to see.
Yeah, we will.
One thing to say that before you jump ahead is this is a bug that was filed on Microsoft Connect.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, as you find bugs, this is a great example of kind of where we're looking at what are the top bugs are, and then obviously fixing them, and within product cycles, launching patches.
That's right. And so if you have feedback on Visual Studio or the .NET Framework, you can go connect.microsoft.com/Visual Studio.
Correct, and that's where this one was. It was.
Exactly.
I think one of the top ones. Yeah, one of the top ones.
Yep,
yeah.
We do listen to that.
Not the top one. One of the top ones.
So CoAP. All right, we're trying to figure out exactly how to describe this.
Yeah,
you've
so
got it.
So the idea is you're trying to distribute an open source project, and there's a lot for say that on that are cross platform, like C++ ones, where there's Linuxy or Unixy things,
mm-hmm.
Like file systems or different controls or different make files or different dependencies, all that stuff. That stuff you want to take the pain out of. You also have an open source project that has dependencies, a lot of stuff. I'll give you an example. I think for Tweetcraft, we had, if you were distributing, if you were trying to load up the Tweetcraft project, we have dependencies on a mocking library. We have dependencies on a unit testing library. We have dependencies on all these things. So you may need to, say, go to these different repos,
mm-hmm.
and maybe if those DLLs aren't built, like they're all in, say, a makefile, you'd have to build your own, but if they weren't built with the right compiler, there's just a lot of pain in getting source code projects up and running. The idea with this is it gives you a way to do sort of a package management system, so I can say, here's my application, here's all the things that it needs, the prereqs, and here's all the dependencies it has, and just make it really easy for somebody to get set up. So this is an open source project. You can check it out at CoAP, and obviously watch Charles's video where they go through in much more detail on how this stuff works.
So is this designed for a developer to get other developers, other contributors on board with the project? Or is it designed for a developer of an open source project who's releasing that to the end users of that project?
It's really for developer to developer.
Okay. That's what I needed to know.
Yeah. So
that makes sense.
So a good example is the FFmpeg library,
mm-hmm.
comes only in source, like not a DLL. So that way you have to find somebody that can handle all the requirements and which version of a DLL to mm-hmm. build and the makefile. The makefile has, you know, maybe things that break, and there's just a number of things within there.
Got it.
That you got to figure out.
Nice.
Yeah. So promising.
Yes.
Promising.
So this is Brian Peake. So
yeah.
We had, I think this is the same system that we had a submission for Show Off a couple years ago, right? Where it's basically
Rick Barraza, yeah.
Yes, exactly. It's a mind reading library, and a lot of people looked at this and thought that it was fake, but it's legit. It's real. You can actually go get this, and so the idea is that you put on this headset, and they could actually detect brainwave patterns, and then you can read off of that and use that to drive certain application experiences. And so Brian Peake, doing what he does best, like when he went out and wrote the .NET wrapper for the Wiimote, he went out and wrote a .NET wrapper to work with these. The Think Gear. So.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we showed this off at PDC and I think Mix. My mm-hmm. life is kind of blurry. But his app was the stronger you concentrate, it would read your brain waves and explode something up so it could actually do sort of like a real-time reading. The API is dirt simple, as you can see as an example. So.
Nice.
Cool stuff.
That's cool. jQuery Mobile. So version of jQuery available for mobile developers.
Yeah, and it's really designed and optimized. So one, it's small, mm-hmm. and it has specific things that you would want, you know, with input controls, the right way to do formatting, and a number of different things within there. So it's nice that a lot of people are using jQuery, including us on Channel 9. So it's nice that you can use jQuery, the same skills that you have in jQuery, you can use on jQuery Mobile.
And there's something about it being optimized for touch interfaces as well. Now, how do you optimize a jQuery library for touch?
It's probably a good question. I think they're just trying to build it such that, you know, let's say, for example, you have movable items. Mm-hmm. All movable items are, you know, in a max size div or something like that. So, like, if, for example, if you have a browser that can do HTML5, that can do moving. Okay. I don't know. I'm just theorizing on what it would be to make sure things like the hit area, the target area would work.
Got it. Okay. So getting started with PowerShell. This is actually a question that my brother, he's actually also a Microsoft employee. He works over in the Office team, and he uses scripting tools all the time to manage labs and
What's his
build
name?
Labs. Danny Keller.
Am I your brother?
No, not you.
Oh,
no, the other Daniel in my life. Sorry.
Okay.
And so he came to me and said, "Hey, how do I get started with PowerShell?" Like, you search for PowerShell and you come back with all these like scripts that you can be a script kiddie and you can mm-hmm. edit and you can customize. But how do you actually get started? What's the pedagogical, like, step by step? How do you
pedagogical?
Look it up,
Jesus.
Man. Pedagogical.
Oh,
yeah,
man.
I'm scaffolding here.
Yeah.
So anyway, this is a good series over on the Code Project that takes you step by step through how to use PowerShell.
And Lee Holmes, who's a PowerShell wizard, is coming out with a PowerShell cookbook.
Oh,
and
nice.
I personally like the cookbook style thing because I can, you know, it's so many of the things are like, yeah, I want to do exactly that, you know, change some params.
Exactly.
So cool stuff.
You're a script kiddie at heart.
I am.
So,
picks of the week.
Picks of the week. So my pick of the week is coming back to a theme that I talked about
is
earlier this
month. Is Soma's
blog? This is Soma's blog, but this is talking about the fact that lab management, which a couple weeks ago we announced that it was going to RTM later this month.
Mm-hmm.
Technically, it's an RTW because it's not a release to market. It's a release to web. It's a download you can go get.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it's available today, and you can download it. You can update your lab management server, which is really Team Foundation server, and then you can update all of your test clients, like Microsoft Test Manager needs to get an update, and then all of your agents, which are actually part of your test environment, get updates as well. So this takes you through step-by-step what needs to be updated, where you download all the updates, and if you missed the announcement at the beginning of the month, lab management is effectively now included if you already have Visual Studio 2010 Test Professional with MSDN or Visual Studio Ultimate with MSDN. So there's no longer a need to license a separate server component. As long as you have TFS, you've got lab management now.
Mm, okay. So if you have TFS, you're golden.
TFS with Visual Studio Ultimate and or Visual Studio Test Professional.
Now, do the every test head that would need to hit this stuff would need a license?
Every tester? Like a
yeah.
person? Yeah, every person that works with lab management, that's a good way to think about it, would need to have either Visual Studio Ultimate on the developer side or Visual Studio Test Professional on the tester side. So the majority of the licenses that an organization would buy would be Test Professional licenses. Those are going to be the people running your manual tests, setting up the test environments, filing bugs, that sort of thing.
Okay, yeah. Cool. And my pick of the week is Karsten, who went through The Archivist,
mm-hmm.
which we've talked about, is an online service that acts as an archive for Twitter mm-hmm. tweets, for lack of a better word. So you can do a search term. It'll remember the tweets that you sent and save them to the cloud. So I think the cool part about this, and obviously is there's a lot of utility here, is that in the service, but the cool part is that Karsten goes through is, hey, you know, I'm a .NET developer. I'm going to go through multiple steps, the multiple steps that I did in building the architecture. So phase one was like classic SQL model. Phase two was a bunch of different workers. Phase three was kind of a mix in there. It goes to like having, you know, these queues and then seeing where the performance bottlenecks are. And all the different things where they were waiting within queues and separating them out and doing a mix of both SQL and Azure Table Storage. Azure Table Storage for the really big data and SQL kind of for the almost like the metadata about the tweets, like the search term and stuff like that. So lots of cool stuff for people that are building Azure applications. I highly recommend it for you to go through because it's an easy read as well.
Right.
Love it.
Nice. Very cool.
Yeah.
And that's it. So we will see you next week.
Thanks.